Welcome, and this is the third session on St. Francis of Assisi. There's another group studying St. Dominic, if any of you are mixed up. I'm just kidding. So welcome. Our sharing today is going to be so parallel to the Bible study this morning. They just happened to converge. Because today we're going to look especially at the heroic attempt that Francis made to not just heal a few people or preach the gospel to a few people, but to stop the Fifth Crusade. So, are you ready?
Yeah.
For this?
Yeah.
And this is a very, very fascinating material today. And I'm excited about it. Only my voice never shows that. It's as excited as I ever get.
Dan, mm-hmm. You want to say anything about the picture before we take
let's
it down?
Do this first.
Then I don't have to shine a light in your face.
Yeah, this is, I forgot the artist at all of the...
I don't remember the artist either.
Giotto.
Yeah, that's right.
Giotto.
That's right.
The frescoes in the great Basilica of St. Francis that was Elias's idea. And this sometimes has been told the most striking work of art in history that portrays the contrast of the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. As Francis and his brothers meet Pope Leo III and request permission and to have their order accepted and received and official and all of that. And here it shows the Pope giving the permission to Francis. And if you can just imagine, this is probably the most eloquent kingly court in all of medieval Europe. And this was the absolutely glory time of the church. And so what a contrast. And so I wanted to just show that as we begin now. And if you are ever in Assisi, this is one fresco among countless frescoes of the life of Francis in that basilica. And also downstairs in the basilica is the burial place of Francis. So this is... So, thank you. We can turn that off now. I will begin with we left yesterday with talking about the what were called the Pentecost meetings of the Franciscans, and I just want to just say a word about those. One mentioned yesterday that they tried to get Francis to combine his order with the Benedictines, and I was wrong, it was the Dominicans. So I'm sure you all noticed that grievous error. And now we want to go into Francis and his missions. But first, a little about the chapters. Where by the time there were thousands of Franciscans, they still met every second year and later every third year in a great field outside, down the hill from Assisi. And if you could imagine that, because one of Francis's chief talents was not administration. This is what Elias did. And to have thousands of monks, and just think of this is before they had what do we call them, the
porta potties.
Just to get food and feed all of these people. And then it was very non-hierarchical. There would be a dividing into the different groups from different parts of the world. And think of the miles and miles they traveled to come to this meeting. And also when we go over the years of the beginning of the Franciscan orders, this meeting more and more became a place of tension between those who wanted to keep the order with the original life, and then there were what we would call today the realists that wanted to adapt it and really meant compromise. This is also Francis thought of these meetings as like King Arthur's knights at the Round Table. Remember talking about how influenced he was by the medieval court. They would then there see the first followers, they meet the new brothers and welcome those who have joined in the last period. They would receive from Francis paternal advice, add to the rule if it was necessary. And so the food came from the surrounding towns. People and third order people possibly brought the food. And then they organized this field into the provinces of the Franciscan order that were by this time throughout Europe. And then they, to avoid hierarchy, they used servant names. There wasn't like a president, vice president, and like that, but there were ministers, custodians, and guardians. So now I want to move to if Francis had one passion, was missionary work. To bring to Christ those who had not heard of Christ. And also his deepest passion was to preach and show the example of Christian love that would result in the Muslims being converted to faith in Jesus. So I have this as a background as we at the same time now, the 1219, the Fifth Crusade is beginning. And to think of the Fifth Crusade and to think of the heart of Francis and how Europe, after the First, Second, Third, and Fourth Crusades, is now all of the propaganda now is going out for the Fifth Crusade. And we know the very important part of propaganda to make a war successful. It was of Christ, it was of God, it was God's will, it would succeed, and it will be done by military power, by conquering the Muslims and then incorporating them into the Christian empire. So Francis senses a call to go to Egypt where the Christian forces are gathering. And the setting is, this is, if you don't know, this is the Mediterranean and this is Italy and Greece. A very accurate map. Jerusalem and so much of the Crusades were about, of course, to take back the holy sites in Jerusalem. And now the place, the setting for this war now is at the head, or at the, I always get down and up mixed up, down the Nile, where it flows into the Mediterranean. And of course, this is an area of deltas, of mud, of very damp, and many streams, part of it change over the years and centuries, flowing into the river. And then in order to get to Jerusalem, the plan was to first conquer Damietta, which was a seacoast town. And then upon defeating the army, Muslim armies here, then to move on to Cairo. The only way to get to Cairo, any other way would be going through extreme desert. So then from Cairo, then to sweep up and take the holy sites of Jerusalem. So now Francis sends us a call to go and to preach to the Christian armies and the Christian generals to stop the war. He also realizes he will have to speak to Muslims, so he takes Brother Illuminato with him. And dear Illuminato was a chosen one, also the only one who spoke Arabic. So you can see why he was chosen. And the stories about the crossing of the Mediterranean Sea to Damietta are horrid. In a boat that's just crammed with soldiers, poor and rich and different classes, and crowded, and the sanitation and the lack of food. It was a journey across the Mediterranean. We wouldn't, you know, it's too hard to think about how terrible it was. And then to get to where the, when I say Christian, we all think of two parentheses around the word here. So to get to the Christian armies, and then there Francis found another mess. All of these people, thousands and thousands, who had gathered here for a variety of reasons. There were the knights in armor that this was going to be their time of glory. There were the peasants, just multitudes of peasants who were promised forgiveness of all of their sins and going immediately to heaven in this battle for Mother Church. And then there were the division between different classes of people. And there were differences between those from different countries, and all the stresses and the strains of all these people together. And add to that the problems of food and the problems of sanitation. And there in the middle of it was the captain of the Christian army. He was a cardinal. His name was Pelagius. And now Pelagius was one who, any parallels are accidental, but he, in spite of all the odds, he deep in his heart wanted to go to war. That was his great desire, and no one could stop him. And so he was the general now of the troops. And when the battle began, the Muslims had a great advantage in they had a military genius as their leader, Al-Malik al-Kamil. And from now on, I'll just say the Sultan. And you'll know, but it's Al-Malik al-Kamil. And Karn and I, in July, is it still July? This was, this first part of July. We traveled from Seattle to Lindsberg, Kansas. It's where everybody wants to go in the summer. How many have been to Lindsberg?
No.
One.
How many have been to Kansas?
Actually, the weather was mild, sunny summer weather.
Is it where Bethany is?
What's that? And where Bethany College is. And it's also a real, it's a Swedish center. And what we were going to was the biannual conference of the Augustana Heritage Society, which means all the old Swedes in the Lutheran Church. And when we, how did I get to Kansas? Where was I going with this? Something about the Sultan.
Well, you said early in July you went there.
I think, I remember. On the way there, we rented a car and stopped at Abilene. There is the birthplace of Dwight Eisenhower, the home where he grew up, a beautiful museum, his burial site. And also all kinds of readings about him and quotes from Eisenhower, and then a propaganda, a film. Well done, otherwise. But on the life of Dwight Eisenhower, the brilliant, brilliant general who led the Allied forces in the invasion of Normandy. And one thing they were very clear to point out is that Eisenhower hated war. He hated war. And for him, it was a task to be done, hurting his thinking. And he would have been like Al-Malik, Al-Kamil. His country or his people had called him to do this, but he hated it, wanted it to be over, and at the same time was a military genius, and also was much more interested in his faith, his life of prayer, reading widely, talking religion, and therefore he was just primed for a visit from Francis. So Francis and Illuminato, they take off and they found the headquarters of the Muslim armies probably spread out in tents. And he meets the army of the Muslim people, and first they thought it was, the Muslims had an understanding that any Christian that they find in the territory, they will kill immediately. But somehow they think that maybe Francis and Illuminato are bringing a new peace offer from the Christians because the Sultan's dislike for war. He had offered a peace settlement that was very, very generous, but because of Cardinal Pelagio's need to go to war, it was refused. But then when what happened? One thing I've got to just check on. We're talking about two different wars. We're talking about two different wars, and I've got a little mixed up there. But what happens in that meeting and that encounter is that he realizes that Francis is a very spiritual person. And if anything he loves to do is to talk about religion, he would have taken every comparative religion class at TLU or any other place. And as I said before, he was also deeply pious Muslim. So now Francis' idea is to convert him. And so Francis has different ideas about converting him. One, he presents Christ to him, and Sultan listens very, very carefully. And this leads to a dialogue. And the more they talk together, the more they realize, both being deeply pious people in their religions, that they have very, very much in common. But Francis still wants to convert him and keeps challenging him to follow the way of the truth. And the Sultan is the one that discourages Francis to do what he wants to do. He remembers the three men in the fiery furnace, so he wants the Muslims to build a fiery furnace, and he'll walk into it. And fortunately, the Muslims don't allow him to do that. But Francis charms, one thing we must remember, all through Francis' life, he was a comedian, he was Mr. Personality, and he was charming and deeply, deeply pious as a Christian. Then he offers him a way to end the wars. If you consent to be converted to Christ with your people. Now, if anybody asked this of a Muslim, then they could be killed immediately at that time. But however, I don't know how to say this other than they like each other. And they start talking about faith. And Francis tells them about Christ, or him, the Sultan, and tells it in a beautiful and poetic and gentle way, which is very, very appealing to the Sultan. But then Francis opens himself up then to listen to the Sultan. And from these days and days, a boring time in war is between wars, or waiting and waiting and waiting. And now Francis is willing to listen to him. And Francis is deeply touched by his faith in God. And always to remember, Allah is simply Arabic for God. And when the Lutherans and others in the Holy Land now, the Arabic Christians, they worship Allah. That's everywhere there's God in the liturgy, it's Allah. So so Francis hears him and realizes here is a man of deep faith, devotion, disciplined prayer, and who believes in the one true God. And this is where Francis is converted, the realization that, yes, we do worship the one God. One quote, Francis relativizes the necessity of preaching and baptism for salvation, explained on the basis of a profound personal experience of the presence of God among the Saracens. A presence which Francis expressly wished to respect. The simplest way to put this is that they just liked each other. You know, it's like that. Isn't there an old song that says, "I lied"? I don't remember that.
Don Quixote.
Don Quixote. Yes.
I like him. Why are you following him?
Who was the man?
Sancho
Panza.
Sancho.
I lied, and I really lied.
Yeah.
Pluck my fingers and tear out my toes. Something like that.
Yeah, I just
lied. I lied. And Well, this now leads us to that you cannot be talked out of this war. So they now attacked Damietta. And it's a brutal, brutal battle. And what happens in this battle, it seems at first like the Christians are winning, but then the Sultan was a military genius and also took advantage that they were on familiar territory. And so he knew exactly how the tides run. And then if he could make it look like he was retreating, he would pull the Christian armies into the delta in the place that's dry during the low tide, and which it worked with precision. And the tides came, and most of the Christian army was trapped and drowning. And this was, if you're in, this should be used probably at West Point, you know, to teach strategy or something. But it was a crushing defeat for the Christian armies. And there was an estimate there were between 4,000 and 6,000 that were killed. Now, having won this war, the Sultan makes a peace proposal. And when you read this peace proposal, why, after winning, would he give such a liberal peace peace proposal? It was a place in the Holy Land that was to be part of the, they could have the holy sites. It was just kind of, he showed how deeply he wanted peace. And of course, Pelagio said absolutely no. And that meant the preparations now for the second battle. And what happened during this time is many Christian armies, many Christian soldiers were just seeing this war as worthless. And they were also hearing the preaching of Francis. He gathered the soldiers around and started preaching to them. And all of a sudden, he found this as a great recruiting place for monks. And an amazing story about how, with his personality and the message of the gospel and the message of peace and the futility of war, that many of the soldiers did come and enter the Franciscan order. So now again, Francis is pleading with Pelagio to accept the offer of peace. But again, and I don't want to say too much about this, but it almost reminds me of an administration in the United States. Going into Iraq, there was this kind of irrational passion against all the evidence. Am I saying too much for, that's my personal opinion and not the opinion of the entire ELCA. But the similarity of just having this obsession with killing and war and taking land. So the preparations now are being made now for the next attempt of the Christians to again take Damietta and then get up to the Holy Land to take the Holy Land. And this time they have reorganized. Many, many new troops have come. Careful plans have been made to take the city of Damietta. Which is filled with families and children and civilians and normal normal people. And on top of military strategy to just do the work, among Christians there's an intense hatred of Muslims. And there is this kind of, I can't wait to kill as many as I can. And the back and forth of brutality, just to, the armies could see each other before this war, and when the Christian captured Muslims, they would put their bodies on stakes going all the way up and down, and so that the Muslim people far away could see them. And then they would seek revenge, and you know how that builds up, the cruelty of war when there is such deep hatred for one another. So the Christian armies attacked the city, and after grueling weeks of slaughter, they break through the wall of Damietta, and then it is not a matter of taking the city, it is a bloody massacre of not only soldiers, but men and women and children. It would be one of saying Rachel weeping in Damietta because her children are no more. So now the Christians have triumphed in this. I'm sorry. I get mixed up on history, and I hope I'm going right here. Forgive me. The Christians. They lose the first war. I'm on track. And then now this is the second war.
How long could they hold on to the captured city then? What happened after? Didn't they counterattack then, the Muslims? How long would the Christians hold such a conquered land?
They would. I don't know about this. I'd never be asked to teach at West Point. I don't know.
You're saying battle. Mm-hmm. They lost the first battle in the Delta, but the second battle, after a long siege, they won, technically.
It's all part of the Fifth Crusade.
Okay.
Yeah, they lost the first battle. And then they succeeded. I hope I'm right about it.
May I ask, why were they, now that they have Damietta, by whatever means, why were they going to go to Cairo instead of shooting up to Jerusalem?
Yeah.
So that reinforcements wouldn't come from Cairo? Kind of a long way around.
Let's see if I have this in another place. My notes seem to be mixed up here. Okay, Francis shipped to Egypt, terrible conditions, Muslims under the command of Sultan Alamdi, and then Francis and Illuminato go, they're brought to the court of Alamdi, charms and sets up Muslim-Christian dialogue, and then this is important. The defeat the Muslim armies, take the city, corpses placed through the raping, his voice is lost, and then he takes a boat to Syria. Yeah, I was right. Yeah. Now, what was the question? The Christian armies take the defeat the Muslims in the second battle. And now the other questions, I just don't know the answers to. I'll see if I can find them for tomorrow. Also. So,
she was asking why take Cairo,
yeah.
And why not just go straight to Jerusalem?
Yeah, like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this morning and figured out that it must have, maybe they did. This is my report for tomorrow. Maybe they did. I might be mixed up.
Cairo is the capital, kind of the dominant city. That's the reason.
And actually, the miles aren't that great yet.
No.
It's not like they're a couple thousand miles apart.
So that's a question, how they got from Damietta. Now I just remembered. Okay, here it comes. They didn't have to go to Jerusalem because they had won the war, and then the peace settlement was made. So then the holy sites. This was the last crusade. And now the holy sites are in the hands of the Christians because of this battle.
Well, then did they accept the Sultan's peace offer then?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the defeat of Damietta?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
he was willing to have a two or three state solution without the war.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And I'll try to straighten some of this out last year, and I'm so pleased this is on tape. You know, vulnerable you were.
Dan, this is what we're hearing, though. They defeated this huge Muslim army,
mm-hmm.
as well as breaking the walls and killing all those people. The army was defeated, and many of them killed. So that at this point, the Sultan, if he's still alive, I don't know about that, could not raise another army, so they had what they were there for.
Mm-hmm. And that's right. But I'm going to give a really correct.
So then what did Francis do next?
Okay, what does he do next? He gets to Syria. He gets to Syria because... And to the Holy Land, because the promise was made that he would be free to visit the Holy Land. And this is why Franciscans to this day still are keepers of the holy sites. So every place you go that's a holy site, you'll find a Franciscan monk, and that goes all the way back to the 1200s. And when we were there, it was during the short skirt era. And Karin had a long skirt that the Franciscan thought was short. So she didn't get to go into the holy sites. So just a little word about dressing for the Holy Land. So that was, but it is the Franciscans. Now, Francis finds his way up to Syria, and there, one of the brothers is there to meet him and intercept him. And now comes the beginning of the Francis era of some have called the crucifixion or the passion of Francis. Because he gives a report that the order is in disarray. Now, what had happened while he was gone is that Brother Elias has really taken over the order. They've changed the rules to make them more comfortable. And Francis comes back to realize he is no longer the leader of the Franciscan order. And this causes Francis now to go into sorrow and depression that leads him into a time in his life which is most of the time he's off praying in the spirit, especially on a small mountain, Liverna, which was given or loaned to the Franciscan order, and goes there and prays, and his closest brothers are with him, and they leave him alone but are close enough in case he becomes extremely ill or sick that they will be there. And it is here on the mountain that Francis is deep in prayer, having lost his dream, that he meets, has the vision of the angel, and the angel marks Francis with the wounds of Christ, called the stigmata, on his hands and on his feet and on his side. And that's why when you see this famous early picture of Francis, it shows the five wounds and a little rip in his garment on this side, so you can see the side wound. Then, this is when he follows the way of the cross and reaches the spiritual point of really losing everything. But you might say Jesus, in a way, does not leave him. But I'm going to say a little more about the one who really stuck by him in vision and dream all the way through, and that's Sister Claire. Quite a bit younger than he is, and I think she lived 30 to 40 years after Francis. And then Francis and she seldom ever met because of the medieval kind of understanding to stay away when we've made the promises. But once the two of them met for dinner. Now, dinner was always on the ground for St. Francis. You would never have a table. And they shared a dinner, and together they entered in such a state of ecstasy that these are the reports that later that the people in Assisi could see flaming fire coming out of this dinner. This was a hot lunch. But they never have probably two mystical saints being more of one mind. She never compromised the original dream of Francis. And there's another story about Claire. That what was this one? I must off track here. He had. I'll get back to that. But Francis had one. He had one woman friend, and whom he called Brother was a wealthy widow in Rome. And the few times that Francis went to Rome, he would always go over to Brother. You know what I mean by Brother? She was an honorary brother, according to Francis, which was kind of a feller. it's kind of like saying men are better than women, but that's the way it was, or how he called her. And what he did in Rome was when she shared his dream, and she also made these cookies with pecan nuts and sweet little cookies. And the years when he was away from Yokiba, he would dream about the next time. So if you ever are asked, did Francis give up everything? Yes, everything, except Yokiba's cookies. Well, I'm going to stop there for today. And again, apologies that I got confused on my notes. Let's just add, if you have questions.
But he called Claire sister?
Sister.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, was she one down from?
Well, might have been.
It was all because of the cookies.
We'll get to the last day when Francis was on his deathbed, that she came up from Rome, and so he had one more taste of her cookies before he died. These are the little things that were humanizing, aren't they? Yeah.
I suppose there's no way to know, but it's interesting that they let him on the boat to go along in the crusade. Is that the Catholic Church underestimating the danger of someone like Francis?
My guess is they didn't know who was getting on the boat.
Yeah.
And there have just been crowds and crowds. And
so he just traveled along as part of the thing. Yeah.
Dan?
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about the Franciscan Order currently, like in the U.S., where are they headquartered, or what is their mission, or how do they see?
Yeah, they're all over the world. Yeah. Yeah. And one thing next time we'll explain is how the order was modified after Francis died. Basically, that would be the rule that they follow today. You know, where they they have houses and they have books and they have things.
In the light of what Alan said this morning in his one reference to the passage, "No man comes to the Father but by me," how did they understand that idea of conversion, and how has that changed in the light of, I think he had a different interpretation of that this morning. Would you comment on that at all?
Yeah, if anybody here not be here tomorrow? I better have a little session. How much time? We have 5 minutes. Yeah, quite a few will not be here. And I'll mention it quickly here, and then we'll enlarge on it tomorrow. But the verse in John wasn't a bother to Francis, but what he took very seriously was Matthew 28, go into all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And that last sentence is basically what the Christian church has left out. Following the way of nonviolence of Jesus, etc. But this is the verse he took very seriously. And growing up, and his whole life was in obedience to Matthew 28. So he went into what we would call a deep conflict of an actual personal relationship with a deeply sincere and pious Muslim person, and I bet we could tell stories too about that where we're just shaken because. The authenticity of faith of another person. And this is what happened to Francis, but he developed from this, or brought together what we would call, I suppose we would call interpretation or hermeneutics, and that there are passages in the Bible that contradict each other. You know, we could list passages that contradict each other in the Bible. And therefore, we must have a source of interpreting every part of the Bible by what, hopefully, by the power of the Spirit, we come to see as the door, the center, and the anchor. And if you're a Lutheran Christian, that doorway is Christ. That you go to every part of the Bible in the Spirit of Christ, and Christ interprets that passage for you. For example, the easiest one is God's orders in the Old Testament to kill people. You enter that passage from the standpoint of Jesus Christ, and you have to say no. Now, what Francis did he was a very interesting inspiration he had. Christians called Muslims wolves. This was just a common, you'd talk about those wolves. And then the Christians called themselves, when they were talking about their relationship to Muslims, they were the lambs. And this was a way that always happens with an enemy, that you give them a name that gives really permission to kill them. Francis was reading Isaiah, and he was reading the vision and the dream of God when the wolf will lie down with the lamb. And he chose, I mean, you could disagree with this, as we could all disagree with each other on every Bible, many Bible verses, but he took this as God's word to him, that after meeting the Sultan, and the Sultan having such a deep and intimate and a personal faith and a relationship to the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, Francis received the call that our ministry from now on will be to show the rest of the world that two people worshiping the same God can fulfill Isaiah and be a witness to the whole world. Now, how he planned this was this, that a group of brothers would move into a Muslim area or a community, and instead of trying to convert them, they would practice, first they would submit themselves to the rules and the laws of that Muslim community as Christians. Then, after submitting from them, then they would live at peace with them and live as equals with them. And then this then would become a witness, a witness to the whole world, that people who have been vicious enemies in Jesus Christ can be the fulfillment of Isaiah, that the wolves and the lambs will live together in peace. So one can agree or disagree with that, but that was, and if you can see the difference between, oh, all religions are the same, you know, one, the other, there's a tremendous difference between that and the depth of the depth of truth, I think, that was behind Francis' struggle.
Did that happen? Did some Christians go there and do what you said? Set up a community?
If so, only in a very limited sense. I mean, By this time, Francis is so close to the end of his life.
You could say that southern Spain and Guernica later becomes kind of the fulfillment of that, when the Muslims and Jews and Christians lived in harmony, when the Muslims were in southern Spain.
It would be interesting to see if that is the, many people think that the Sultan was a Sufi. Sufis are dancing Muslims, joyful dancing.
Dan, I want to just question, when Francis comes back from the Fifth Crusade, finding that Elias has used his administration skills to change things, and that the Christians and the Muslims, he didn't broker peace, did he see himself as a failure, or did he see the world as so full of sin?
Everything that Francis did, he wanted to be like Jesus.
Okay.
And he saw the loss of the order as his crucifixion.
Okay.
He saw what?
As his crucifixion.
And then the stigmata kind of affirmed that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, and he did lose everything that he had, he had lived for, and often it would be a thing to talk about among Christians. What would be our crucifixion?
Thank you.
So that's where his piety was. Oh, we have two more times to talk about this. And first thing tomorrow, a very neat review of the military strategies. Thank you for being accepting.